Welcome to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. This is the place to learn what Dave Ramsey and his team teach about leadership and business. My name is Chris Hogan, and I'm excited to host another great episode for you today. Today on the podcast, we have Ken Blanchard. His series, The 1 Minute Manager, has sold more than 15 million copies and has been translated into more than 25 languages. Ken is one of the premier voices in the leadership space, and I'm so excited to have him on today to talk with us about his new book, Trust Works, 4 Keys to Building Lasting Relationships. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Ken Blanchard.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Now, Ken, without knowing it, you have been a personal mentor of mine. I mean, your books have been instrumental in helping me shape myself as a leader, and I'm so very honored to be speaking with you today.
Well, good. Well, it's my joy, too. So I'm big fans of you all and Dave and everybody, what you're all trying to do.
Well, thank you for that. So tell us, what has Ken Blanchard been up to lately?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a few years ago when I turned 65, I was on the phone with Zig Ziglar, you know, Ziggy.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And he had invited my wife and I to the 59th anniversary of his 21st birthday. And I said to Zig, I said, are you going to retire? He said, there's no mention of it in the Bible, except for Jesus, Mary, David, a couple of other people. Nobody under 80 made an impact. He said, I'm refiring, not retiring. So I'm 74, and I'm having fun refiring. You know, I mean, I got, I think, 4 books come out this year.
Oh, do you really?
You shouldn't do so many. I got a children's book coming out. I got a second edition of another book, and you know, I got one on lead your family like Jesus, besides this whole book on trust work. So it's
yes.
been fun.
Yes. Well, I'm excited. 4 more books coming out. I mean, you are a prolific writer.
Well, it's fun, you know. The publishers say you should only do one every 3 years and then we can really sell it. And I say, well, I'm not doing it for your benefit. I'm having too much fun, you know. My mother used to say, why don't you write a book by yourself? Because I think I've written 55 now, but only 2 by myself, 1 on golf. So many people worked on my golf game, I didn't know who to write it with, and my spiritual journey. But every other one, my 70th birthday, I invited all my co-authors, and about, you know, 60, 65 of them showed up, and we had a day and a half of sharing simple truths and having fun. It was great.
It's amazing. I mean, in reading your book, especially this new one, Trust Works, I love the parables.
Yes.
I mean, you have an art of teaching adults through parable. Is that something you're intentional with?
Yes. You know, my first book I did was a textbook. I was a college professor, and then I went on sabbatical leave to California and met Spencer Johnson at a cocktail party, you know, and Spencer was writing children's books, you know, a whole series of books called Value Tales, you know, the value of a sense of humor, the story of Will Rogers, the value of determination, the story of Jackie Robinson, you know, the value of this and that. And so my wife met him first and hand carried him over, and she said, you guys ought to write a children's book for managers. They won't read anything else. And so he was working on a 1 minute scolding with a psychiatrist, and I invited him to a seminar. He sat in the back and laughed, and he came running up and said, we ought to do the 1 minute manager, forget this parenting thing. And so since he was a children's book writer and I was a storyteller, and our favorite books were Jonathan Livingston Seagull and The Littlest Prince and Jesus Taught by Parable, we said, let's write a story. And so that was the beginning of it, you know, and got such a response. I've just been having fun writing stories ever since.
Well, you do an incredible job. And Ken, I'm curious, you have become this, you know, authority on leadership and management. What is it about leadership and management that intrigues you or just connects with you so much?
Well, I tell you, Chris, I don't like to make a distinction between leadership and management because management always gets the second fiddle. And I think there's 2 parts of leadership. One is the visionary direction part of leadership, you know, and that's what people used to talk about was leadership. And then the other is the implementation, which is how do you keep according to the vision and direction and how do you accomplish the goals. And I think those are 2 parts of leadership. And the visionary direction part is the hierarchy's responsibility. That doesn't mean you don't involve people, but your responsibility to make sure people know what business you're in, you know, what your picture of the future is, what are your values that are going to guide your journey, and then what goals you want to establish. And because leadership is about going somewhere, and so often, you know, nobody knows where you're going. That's why nothing gets done. I mean, one of the big problems in Washington now is we have no vision for our country anymore. We don't know what business we're in. We don't know what our picture of future. We don't have any agreed upon values or goals, and then wonder why nothing gets done. You know, so that's the direction. That's the leadership part of servant leadership. Then management, or, you know, what they used to call, to me, is implementation. And that's when you turn the traditional pyramid upside down, and now your job is to help everybody live according to the vision and accomplish the goals. And so there's the leadership part of servant leadership, and then the servant part. And that's what's got me excited about, is to see when those two are done well together, what a difference it makes.
Yes, it does. And the whole concept of serving, I can tell you right now, with myself as a young leader, if I would have gotten that early on in my career, it would have made a difference in the results that I've achieved.
Yes, I think it really is. And when you see people who get it, you know, for example, I wrote a book with Colleen Barrett, who, you know, took over as president of Southwest after Herb stepped down. But, you know, that whole company, you know, the airline industry has lost money in its history, and Southwest for 40 straight years have made money. Why? Duh, because they think their number one customer is their people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you take care of your people and love on them and train them and all, they get excited about what they're doing because they all have a clear vision that their job is to democratize the airways. They want every American to be with a friend and a relative in a happy time and a sad time. Then when they're excited, then they take care of your customers, which is, you know, your number two most important customer is the people who fly their airlines. And then those people are going to want to come back, and then that takes care of the third most important customer, which is the stockholders and the owners. And Wall Street, Chris, I think, has really goofed up the values around business in a lot of ways because they act like the only reason to be in business is to make money. And then they think, you know, okay, customers, I guess, are important and all, but they think that people are just interchangeable parts. And I don't have anything to do with those organizations because they're just buying and selling companies. They're not trying to create an organization that lasts, like Synovus, you know, in the financial services business. They won the best company to work for so often that Fortune said don't apply anymore, and they started an all-star list.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely dangerous to start to treat people like a commodity. You know, and for you, did you get that early on in your career, or did you have a mentor in your life?
Well, my mentor was my father. He retired as an admiral in the Navy, and Chris, I'll never forget, I won the president of the seventh grade. I grew up in New Rochelle, right outside of New York City, you know, and I came home and I'm all pumped up. And my dad says, congratulations, Ken, but now that you're president, don't ever use your position. He said, great leaders are great because people respect and trust them, not because they have power.
Mm.
And, you know, he said, you know, if he didn't listen to his men, he better watch his tail because he's going to go over the side, you know.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So that was really mentored me tremendously.
Yeah, that is excellent advice. Now, in the book Trust Works, I got it several weeks ago. I sat down, I read it again, thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think you've hit on something that businesses and leaders have forgotten about, is the importance of trust. What drove you to focus on putting this book together?
Well, Cindy Olmsted, who I wrote it with, I look for people who are really doing exciting things, and she'd been studying trust for 20 years, and she would ask people, Chris, you know, describe somebody you trust. What are their characteristics? Somebody you distrust. And she found there was different definitions of trust, and she did a really whole major study and came up that with the ABCD, which there are really four factors in trust, and you can be good at all three and not at one, and then somebody might not trust you. But A stands for ability, which is, do you think the person has the competency to do the job that they've been asked to do? You know, so you tend to trust people who you think are skillful. B stands for believability. This is all about integrity. You know, do they really walk their talk, or do they, you know, speak one way and act differently the other way? Connectedness, the C, is how do you feel about them? Do they care about people? Do they care about you? Do you feel connected to them? And then finally, D D stands for dependability, which is can they count on your word? Are you reliable? So it's a really interesting. We in the back of the book have a section where you can fill an instrument out right away and find out where you think you are on the ABCD. And then at the end of the book, there's an instrument. You say, am I trustworthy? You can give to colleagues and people around you to see what they think. And that can be real kind of interesting, too, you know, so that you can find out how you're being perceived. But trust is so important with leaders. And I think when we lose trust, then people just don't listen to them anymore.
No, I totally agree with you. And I think, you know, as we look at some of the businesses and things that have gone on, we as Americans have lost trust in some things.
Yes, but true, you know. I mean, I was in Europe during the presidential debates, and Chris, to be honest with you, I was embarrassed, you know. I mean, here's the President of the United States and the candidate standing there calling each other liars, and everybody makes all kinds of promises, and they don't do anything. And we really got to rebuild it. We need somebody to come and rebuild the trust.
How do you do that, Ken?
Well, I tell you, you got to first get to the part about, I mentioned to you, the first part of leadership, because leadership is about going somewhere. You got to do the visionary work, you know, which is, you know, you got to make sure everybody understands what business you're in. You know, at Southwest, they're in the customer service business. They happen to fly airplanes. You got to know what the picture of the future is, and if you do a good job, you know what's going to happen. You know, with them, yes, I said they want to democratize the airways, and then you need a set of operating values that can guide people's journey, and not just things that are up on the wall, but people believe. And at Southwest, they have four values that everybody knows. The first one is safety, because the business they're in, but then they have three values that they want everybody to engage in every single day. And one is a warrior spirit. That's not combative, but if you got a job, do it. You know, and that's why they can turn a plane around in 10 minutes, you know, because pilots are in throwing garbage away. They don't say, that's not my department and stuff like that. Then the second is they have a servant's heart. They want a servant's heart. And they interview for character and then train for skills. They're not going to put a pilot up there who can't fly, but they're not going to put a pilot up there who thinks they're a big deal. And then finally, the fun-loving attitude, which is, you know, Herb's deal. You know, a friend of mine was flying recently, and the steward got on the thing. He says, last flight of the day, and we're really tired. We don't have the energy to pass out the peanuts and the potato chips, so we're going to put them on the floor up front, and when we take off and get some height, they'll come down the aisle, and so you can get them if you need them. And, you know, everybody's laughing.
Yes.
So I wrote a little paper called Leadership Vision for America. Try to get it in people's hands and all. But the first one is, again, we don't have a vision for the country. And without vision, you can't, you know, build trust, because people got to know where you're going. And then it's your job to do everything to help people get there and all. And it's not about you. It's not about you, you know, I. It's about them. About helping them accomplish the goals.
Wow, that's strong. And I looked at the book and I was reading, and of course I love the situations that you put the animals in the parable.
Yeah.
Just because it speaks to real life as individuals. But you've got a section in the book, and it's titled Matter of Perception, and it really got my attention.
Well, you know, you can think that you're just doing fabulous, you know, God, I'm building this great relationship. But if people see you differently, you know, I mean, because some people say, my door is always open, come to see me, but you got to go through three secretaries to get to them. And when you get in their office, they got this huge mahogany desk that they sit behind, and you have to sit on the other side, you know, and all. And so all kinds of things say to you, God, this person's not believable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They think, man, you know, I told them my door's always open and all. And so you have to check, because people operate on their perceptions, not yours, you know. And I'll give you an example. I gave the instrument to all my staff that works with me. And I'm in the office, we call it the office of Ken. And the one area where I fell down on was dependability, because Chris, my biggest problem is that I've never really heard a lousy idea, you know, and so I get too excited, you know.
Yes, sir.
So I'll meet a guy in a plane, you know, and I'll say, God, that's a great idea. And pretty soon, you know, they're moving to San Diego because they think that I'm going to co-author this thing with them and all. And so they said, you know, I just need to, you know, be careful of my yeses so I can follow through. So you get a kick out of it. Now I can't take my own card with me on trips. I take my executive secretary's card. And so if I give a card away, they got to call her first. And she says, what did Ken say? But see, it's so helpful, you know, because they really helped me realize, oh, yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about that. I'm just an excited guy.
Yeah, absolutely. You put a gatekeeper in place for yourself.
That's right, you know, but it was their perception that really helped me, you know.
Well, and it's interesting because not only were you willing to get the feedback, but you acted on it, Ken.
Yes. Well, I learned that a long time ago from my father, you know, the feedback is the breakfast of champions, you know.
Hmm.
He used to tell me, if you didn't hear complaining from your men, you know, watch your tail because you're going over the side because your people have cut you off from the lines of communication and you don't know what the issues are, you know.
Wow.
And a lot of people set up organizations where they want everybody sucking up the hierarchy and telling them how great they are. And I want to tell you, that's the beginning of a disaster with leadership.
Wow. So staying connected with your people, it's imperative.
Yes, and that connected piece is such an important part of the whole trust thing. You know, do they really think that you listen? Do you, you know, are you interested in them as human beings? You hear their ideas, and you really feel connected to them.
Well, and I love in the book that you go through, and you've got these things that are trust boosters, and you have things that are trust busters. And I love that because it shows people, if you're doing this, this is what you can do to fix it.
Yes.
And again, going back and giving people a map to follow. And you have a line in here that I love that's following on connection. You said, just as sunlight cannot pour through a window with the curtains closed, trust cannot enter your life if you hide behind a wall.
Yes.
And that's amazing because it allows us, you have to be open to people.
Yes, and to listen and hear, you know. One of my favorite sayings, Chris, is none of us is as smart as all of us, you know.
Hmm.
And one of the biggest failings in leadership is when they think all the brains are in the executive office, you know, and that I don't think we end up using our people enough as our partners, you know.
How would a leader treat people as partners? I mean, you obviously, if you're the leader, there is a hierarchy.
Yes.
But how do you go about beginning to treat people as partners?
Well, I think what you got to do is assume that they really care about the same things that you are. I'll give you an example. In 2009, we knew by February that we would probably be almost 25% below our projected sales in our company. You know, we have 320 people in an office in Toronto and London and Singapore and all. And every quarter, we meet with everybody in the company, and people come in online and through teleconferencing and all that. The first thing we do is we go over the balance sheet with them. And people say, you do what? Say, yeah, we even brought in people to train everybody how to read a balance sheet because our people care, because we have a gain sharing that kicks in if we make a 5% profit. We also have a give back program where we give a percentage of our profit to everybody equally to give to charities of their own choice, because we want them to, you know, find out the power of tithing and all that. And so our president, who is my wife's brother, he's got tears in his eyes showing him what it looks like, and he said, we need your help, you know. And then next month we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of our company. It was a two-day party at Hotel Del Coronado, and we took the first day and brought an outside group in, and we divided our 300 plus people into small groups. And we said, okay, now these groups, we want you to talk about how we can cut costs, this group, how we can increase revenues, you know. And we got unbelievable suggestions from our people, including, why don't we all take salary cuts? Why don't you stop bagging 401k and all that kind of thing? And so everybody took a hit and all. And at the end of the year, we did end up you know, a little bit below, 25% below our image, but we didn't lose any people. Everybody took some of the pain, and as we it started to turn around, then we started sharing back, because people will kill and do anything for you if you treat them like they're partners, and why wouldn't they care? It drives me crazy, Chris, these companies where they'll have a financial problem and all of a sudden they'll lay off thousands of people, and I'll talk to people in the company. They say, we didn't even know we were in financial trouble. Well, why didn't you ask people? They know where all the problems are. Hmm. I mean, Southwest, when they had gas problems, they said, we need your help. And they have this thing, Business Select now, where you can pay $50 and get up front in the A line, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was suggested by a mechanic, I think. You know?
Wow.
You know, and so if you involve them, they'll help you solve the problems.
Hmm. That is a very good piece of advice, to involve your people. Be willing to listen and stay connected. This area of trust can, as you look at it, for some leaders out there, they may have made some mistakes in the past. They may have broken some trust and it's damaged. What can they begin to do to fix it?
Well, first they got to realize that there's a problem, and secondly, they got to own their part in that problem and face up to it and say, you know, hey, what can we do to rebuild this? Because I think there's been a problem here, and I own my piece of this, and I'd really like to see what we can do to rebuild the trust. And people really respond to that. You know, it's really interesting that people admire your skills, but they love your vulnerability.
Hmm.
Oh, and if you will admit you made a mistake, my God, people just go, wow. Isn't that fabulous, you know? I mean, but this idea of acting like you got to be perfect all the time, they all know you aren't. You got clay feet like just all the rest of us. And so I think we got to share our humanness as leaders, not going around control and looking like, you know, we got it all together.
Well, Ken, and you, I failed on that as a leader early on, not sharing enough about myself, but just talking about business. And in the book, you hit this on the head, and you said a trust booster is to share about yourself. You say in here, when you open up and share about yourself, you demonstrate a vulnerability that engenders trust.
Yes, it really does, because then they know that you're being honest about yourself, and you know what? Then they can start to share their vulnerabilities with you and not get beaten up.
Hmm.
Because, you know, that's why this none of us is as smart as all of us. You know, 1 + 1 can be a lot more than 2 if we, you know, realize what our strengths are and what our areas we maybe need to work on, and we're honest with each other, and we ask for help and involve each other as partners. You know, it's really powerful stuff.
Well, we here, Ken, at Dave's office, we have a zero tolerance on gossip here
yeah.
in our office. And on page 68 in the book Trust Works, you talk about trust buster number 4, talking behind other people's backs.
Yes, it's a friend of mine, Sheldon Harris, who, you know, built the Cold Stone Creameries and has worked in other companies. He calls that, and every company is, and I love it, he calls it integrity communication.
Hmm.
And what he says is that nobody can talk about anybody else unless that person is present. You know, so he said, you know, it takes a little while for people to get it. When they really get it, you know, somebody will say, well, you know, so that, well, why don't we call him? let him be in on this, you know, so that because you can really tear an organization down when people are behind closed walls or talking about each other and gossiping and all. You know, you I love that. That term, integrity communications, that's a real trust buster of connectedness as well as believability, I think.
Yes, sir, it is. And it doesn't mean as a leader you don't have to deal with issues, because you're going to have issues.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And, you know, that doesn't mean that when somebody's not performing well that you're going to, you know, just sit around and do nothing. You're going to talk to them about it and see how you can do it, you know. When I was a college professor, Chris, I was always in trouble because the first day of class, I always give out the final examination. and the rest of the faculty would say, you know, Blasher, what are you doing? I said, I'm confused. They said, you acted. I said, I thought we were supposed to teach these kids. You are, but don't give them the questions in the final. And I'd say, not only am I going to give them the questions in the final, what do you think I'm going to do all semester? I'm going to teach them the answers, you know?
Mm.
And it's, you know, it wasn't a true-false multiple choice or anything like that. It was a hard test. But I wanted them to learn. I mean, this whole concept of, you know, normal distribution curve and screwing a certain percentage of your people, or Jack Welch rank order your people and all, man, you want to tear up trust in an organization, do all that kind of thing. Why wouldn't you want people to get A's? And I wrote a book with Gary Ridge, as the president of WD-40, called Help People Win at Work, and the subtitle is a business philosophy called Don't Mark My Paper, Help Me Get an A. And so if you want to build a great team, you want to, first of all, make sure everybody knows what an A looks like. You know, what are we trying to accomplish? What does good behavior look like? And now, what can we do as leaders to help you get A's, you know? And what's really interesting is, if you really work closely with somebody and they don't get an A, well, you and they both know maybe they're probably in the wrong job, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And is there another job that they could get in that maybe be more consistent? But you're really there to help them win. You're not there to sort people out. I ask people all the time, how many of you go out and hire losers? You know, we lost some of our best losers last year. We need some new losers to fill a low slot, you know.
Well, and I think from a trust component, if the leader is there with someone and they actively want that individual to win, it'll show, won't it?
Oh, for sure.
You mentioned also in the book that everybody needs a cheerleader.
Yes.
And Ken, to be honest, some people may not have a cheerleader.
Yes.
What do you do if you're going it alone, and you're hitting hard times, especially in these economic times, or you're dealing with different difficult teams or whatever it is? What do you do if you're a leader and you don't have a cheerleader?
Well, I think it's tough, you know, to do it by yourself. I think a lot of times leaders just don't go out of their way to get involved in other groups, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm part of a Wednesday morning Bible group with seven guys, and we're on the phone with a Bible teacher for an hour every week. I'm also part of another men's group with nine of us that have been together for 15 years, you know, and meet at least for, you know, half a day once every, you know, 4 or 5 weeks. And our main goal is just to be there for each other, you know. And so when our house burned to the ground in the San Diego fires a few years ago, I mean, it was just amazing. The folks that just wrapped their arms around us, you know, we had lived in that house for 25 years, and we were out of town, and when we walked down the driveway, it looked like somebody had, you know, cremated the place, you know. But with our cheerleaders there, we did a fun thing. You get a kick out of Chris. We had a memorial celebration of our house, and over 100 people showed up and telling stories about their times in our house, and all. It was just a hoot, you know, and people laughing and crying. And you got to reach out sometimes to be a cheerleader for somebody else, and maybe that's the way to get a cheerleader for yourself, is who you can cheer.
Yes. Well, I found that, you know, when you start caring about others, you take the focus off yourself.
Yes.
In the book, Trust Works, without giving away the ending, the animals in the parable are faced with some situations beyond their control. And I think we all are in life, are dealt with situations that are beyond our control. But it's about how we respond to it, isn't it?
Yes. You know, you can't control everything that happens. It's, you know, like the fire. We had no control over that.
Yes, sir.
But that was another way, you know, that people watched us. Because you'll get a kick out of this, Chris. You know, 4 days before the fire, you know, and I didn't even know anything about the fire being nearby, I finished reading a book by John Ortberg called At the End of the Game, It All Goes Back in the Box. And it's a wonderful book about his grandmother, who was a tremendous Monopoly player. And when he played Monopoly with her, she was vicious, you know. And at the end of the game, she had everything. He'd have nothing. And she'd get this big grin. She'd say, John, someday you're going to learn how to play the game. So when he was about 12 or 13, kid moved next door, was a tremendous Monopoly player, and he practiced every single day with his kid. because he knew his grandmother was coming in September, and she arrived, and he ran and gave her a hug and a kiss. He said, "Grandma, how about a Monopoly game?" She said, "Let's go, John." But he was ready for her this time, and he came out of the chute, and he wiped her out, and he was said it was the greatest day of his life, and she smiled and said, "John, now that you you know how to play the game, let me teach you a lesson about life. It all goes back in the box." And he said, "What do you mean? Everything you bought, everything you accumulated, it all goes back in the box. And that, you know, things are meaningful." She said, "The only thing that's really important in life is who you love and who loves you." And I told that whole story 4 days before the fire, including, you know, saying to people, there's two Post-its, piles of Post-its on your desk. One says important forever, ever. The other says temporary stuff. Put a Post-it on everything you see as you're heading home. Mm. Your computer, your desk, your secretary, the Coke machine, the receptionist, your car, and what's at the house. And where are you? And everybody sent me emails and voicemails saying, "Ken, that's so powerful. Because you're right. The only thing important in life is who you love and who loves you."
Hmm.
And the fire was 4 days later. So wow. We couldn't act like, "Oh, my God," you know, because that was all temporary stuff.
That's right. And you were being watched.
That's for sure.
People were watching you. You have an amazing ability to stay positive. What does Ken Blanchard do to stay positive?
Well, I think every morning I just think it's a blessing. You know, I think, wasn't it George Burns years ago said, gets up in the morning, looks at the obituary, and if he's not on the list, he says, "It's going to be a great day." Because, you know, never know what you might learn today, you know, and what you might experience. I'm also playing around with a book with a guy who's taking Margie and I and friends of ours on a number of safaris. He's a wonderful guy, headed the Topeka, Kansas Zoo for years. And the book we're talking about is Life is One Big Game Drive. Because if you head out in a game drive, you never know what you're going to see. You never know what you're going to experience, you know. And that, I think that's what life, it's kind of exciting. I wonder what this day holds. People ask me, what does it take to be successful in life? I said, you know, set some goals, but keep your head up, because you never know what opportunity might come your way, and don't have your head down grinding on that goal and miss an opportunity. You might say, maybe I ought to go in this way instead of that way. And so I'm not sure what's ahead, but I'm excited about it. I've been on a big health kick in the last couple of years because I just decided if I'm going to go to 95 or 100, which I hope I can do, that I want to really be able to move and groove and do things. Norman Vincent Peale was a great inspiration to me. I would pick him up at a plane, and I'd say, "Norman, why don't you wait here, and I'll get the car." He said, "Oh, no," he said, "I've been sitting too long. It's time for a brisk walk." And he and his wife, Ruth, every morning would walk a couple of miles, and they would hold hands, but they wouldn't talk. They called it their alone time together. So I'm really kind of excited about the future. A lot of people are saying, "Oh, God, you know, I'm glad I'm the age I want, you know. I mean, it's going to be awful for grandkids and all that." You know, okay, we got problems today, but we had problems years ago. I read a wonderful quote the other day you know, we should need to stop giving so much money to foreign countries, and people need to stop, need to get out and find jobs and stop living off the government and all this kind of thing. And so the thing said, who said that? So people were saying it must have been Ross Limbaugh and all. No, it was Cicero, 15th century. Talk about giving a nice twist.
Yes.
A wonderful way to.
Absolutely. Ken, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, I really enjoyed it. You're great to talk to, and I hope I didn't just blab along too much. I get excited about things. I missed life to me. Is a very, very special occasion. I don't want to miss it.
Yes, absolutely. No, you have given a lot of great information for our listeners. I'm excited for people to read the book, Trust Works. I look forward to going back and reading it and obviously sharing with people as I travel the country and speak as well. Thank you again for your time, sir, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
All right, you take care of yourself.
All right, sir. Take care. God bless. Well, I want to thank Ken Blanchard for taking the time to be with us today. As always, he brings information and insight into leadership. We want to thank you for tuning in. Remember, stay plugged into this Entree Leadership stuff so you can keep learning and keep leading. Until next time, grow yourself, grow your team, and grow your profits.